If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to Reality TV, the podcast where we cringe watch all the shows we love and love to hate. I'm Jody, and as always, I'm here to give you the rundown on what happened on last night's episodes of TLC's Before the 90 Days and 90 Day Fiancé. There is so much to talk about, so let's just jump right in. Let's just state the double handspring, triple sow cow, double toe loop obvious, and report that we did not see Miriam or our Cirque du Soleil protege Patrick in this episode. And I'm a-okay with that, because it looks like we are going to get repaid handsomely tonight with a Miriam versus Letty showdown, so place your bets now. Let's start with my little possum pup, Larry. Larry only has a few more days in the Philippines, and he reminds us that it's not been an easy road. Immediately we get a cutaway of Papa slaughtering that pig that will forever haunt Larry's dreams, while he's cuddling his little lady Rose in his futon sofa bed combo. A Larry flashback is never complete without his cousin and little person Jean, LPG wife. Larry just knows that despite these hurdles, he and Jenny are meant to be, because they can get through anything as a team. And Larry knows about teamwork. As a McDonald's manager, Larry knows it takes two to fix that ice cream machine to get a proper swirl. And I have a feeling he got to be the lucky fella to do the trust fall during the McDonald's branch manager retreat in 2014. I like to picture Larry as the Michael Scott of McDonald's branch managers. World's best boss. Now, I always question Larry's judgment, but now I think his protein deficiency is affecting his eyesight, because he says he's a 5 and Jenny's a 10. Maybe it's Jenny's dental symmetry that throws me off, but I'm not seeing what Larry sees. But alas, mail order love is blind. Now, guys out there, this is for you. Larry knows a thing or three about proposals, because this is his third time doing it. According to Lawrence, it's all about the place where you ask her to marry you. You know, it sets the tone for the engagement and the marriage, so Larry has picked out the perfect place. An old park in the middle of Manila. And because I minored in internet deep diving with an emphasis on stalking, he took her to Rizal Park. According to Wikipedia, situated in the Manila Bay, it's an important site in the Philippine history. The execution of national hero Jose Rizal on December 30th, 1896, fanned the flames of the 1896 Philippine Revolution against the Kingdom of Spain. The area was officially renamed Rizal Park in his honor, and the monument enshrining his remains serves as the park's symbolic focal point. In Larry's language, it has special people from her country buried there. She's always wanted to see it. So they get to the park, and I know it's going to sound snotty, but I will explain more later. But I wasn't that impressed. But Jenny's happy, and she poses by the tombstone and says, "He's famous, he's my idol." Hopefully Jenny is as easy to impress when the lights go off and Larry takes off his pull-ups for grown-up time. And Larry's been picking up on the Filipino language and says, "You look so pretty, love." And then asks Jenny to hold his ginormous golf umbrella. And it didn't even look like it was raining, by the way. And he gets down on one knee. And he starts manhandling a cheap plastic ring box. His hands were just slapping that thing. Like the man hands episode on Seinfeld, where she's ripping that loaf of bread. That was Larry trying to open the box. Like the opposite of that pretty little One Direction boy who sings Slow Hands. Jenny, with her resting stink face, just stares at him, weighing her options between living, staying in the Philippines with the people she really loves, or future with Larry, crying over the deli counter at the local Albertsons for the rest of her life. Now, after continuing to play patty cake with that ring box during the silence, he asks again, "Oh, well, can you be my wife?" And the thrilled, blushing bride-to-be responds with a tired, "Yeah." So Larry shoves the ring on her finger and then proudly takes his umbrella back. I would love to watch Mary Poppins with Larry. Imagine him in his little footsie pajamas and his newsboy cap on his head, excitedly sitting too close to the TV, singing Spoonful of Sugar while laughing way too hard at that cartoon penguin. Oh, little Larry. Now, about this Rizal Park. Apparently, this place isn't just a little park like they showed. There's all types of Japanese gardens and buildings and fountains and ponds. And Larry chooses this little corner by the grave marker. God damn it, Larry. Always go against your inner voice from now on. He's on top of the world and the bottom of his 401k, but he says, "I have the girl of my dreams. All I have to do is take her where I live." Now, tonight it looks like we're going to see some tears in Larry's eyes, and Jenny is Skyping in, so I don't think he's been able to take her to live with him yet, but we shall see very soon. Let's hop on over to Courtney and Antonio. Perhaps my heart has turned completely to stone, but I found these two completely exhausting and boring as hell to watch. A total chore. After their first segment, I was screaming, "Just get on the motherfucking plane already." I was about to go to my mother's house to do my laundry instead of watch Antonio pretend to cry. Courtney is in her signature turquoise dress, and we get a flashback to that fight in Antonio's Easy Bake Oven apartment. And this is where I start understanding Antonio on a "I got you, bro" kind of level. So let's break this down. Courtney says, "I wasn't expecting to feel this strongly about him. But you flew across the world saying you loved him, that you wanted to meet his family. Who are you trying to convince here, Courtney?" Just as I said last week, Antonio is just trying to run down the clock and tells her, "We lost a few days fighting, and now we have to enjoy the moment. No fight for nothing." So this is a scene where they're at the beach or something, and Courtney says, "It's hard me being here because we went from 0 to 100. I woke up at 5 a.m. and cried for an hour, and then he woke up." Ugh, can you imagine? I'd rather have a newborn again than to have Courtney waking me up at 5 a.m. crying. Crazy why Antonio disappeared for days, huh? And also, you actually went from 0 to 35,000 because you up and flew across the world after never actually hearing this guy's voice, you moron. But she's feeling so drained and trying to express emotion. And she says, "You keep pushing me to be more affectionate. I hold my emotions close." What the fuck is going on here, you guys? She's the one having the bigger feelings, right? He plainly said, "I need to get far away from you. I have to get some space." But now he's telling her to emote more feelings? I am so confused. I can see him saying be more affectionate, but in a way like hey, you're sleeping in my bunk bed, so you want to flamenco like no one's watching and seize the day, like my fancy wall decal says. And as she's trying to tell us that Antonio is saying to express her feelings, we hear him saying, no scare, no think about. Enjoy your time with me. I think about nothing. I think about present. Focus now. Enjoy the time. That was a good way to placate her for about, 5 minutes, because Courtney pulls her hair up. Thank ay Dios mío, because she actually looked cute. Ponytails are your friend, Courtney. And she's got to start in again on the only sure way to push Antonio away. And that's to talk about how you don't know where you stand. She said the 3 weeks feels like 2 years. And I think all of us and Antonio agrees, because he has way more gray hair this week than he did when we saw him last time. Courtney's packing up for the airport and she is a mess. And not just the horrible black cotton dress she's wearing with gym shoes. She cannot stop crying. The humidity in the easy bake oven has wreaked havoc on her hair. And Antonio either has a fear of airports or he has to do laundry really badly. Paid gentleman friend to may or may not entertain you in your bedroom, because he doesn't think he should go to the airport. Again, remember, he didn't go pick her up at the airport. Interesting. Again, more confusion with these two. What Antonio is saying in his one-on-ones is consistent with his behavior with Courtney. He says he has feelings for her, but he doesn't know if it's love. He's thinking logically, and logically the distance is going to be hard. But then Courtney tells us, I wish he would give me more commitment. He doesn't want me to date other people. I don't think it's realistic that he's going to be faithful to me while he's halfway across the world. And then, she says, I think Antonio's confused with how he feels, but he can sort it out once I leave. Oh, I think he knows how he feels, but Courtney is pulling a Patrick here. He's telling her how he feels, just like Miriam did, but he's trying to be nice, but she's reading way more into it. So these two have been playing coy on Instagram with each other, so we'll see how it shakes out tonight, but clearly they're not together, right? He's not that into her. Well, Sean has shaken the scabies out of his clothes and has been in quarantine for a month back in Springfield, Ohio. Looking back, he never would have thought he'd come back to Ohio a single man, not engaged to a barely legal girl he met on the internet. He thought he'd be a proud swirler. And if you're asking yourself, did Jody just say that? Yep, I did. Sean proudly describes himself as a swirler on his Instagram profile. Go check it out. Little old naive me thought he may have been referring to Larry's teamwork at fixing that chocolate ice cream machine at McDonald's, but nope. It means what you hope it doesn't, and that little fact will burn itself deep into the synapses of your brain. And it will come back to haunt you every time you see a swirly twirly gumdrop this Christmas. Thanks for ruining candy canes for me, Sean. Now, when Sean left Haiti a month ago, he told Abby, it's me or Chris. And they've been talking a lot now, and he's cautiously optimistic. He wants to give Abby a chance to prove her trustworthiness and honesty. very funny, said the planet. So he's packing up the junior section at Ross Dress for Less, and he's headed back to Haiti. The softy that Sean is, he's finding it more difficult this time because he's had the chance to physically touch her. Excuse me while I try to keep my gag reflex to a minimum. It was hard before the first time he went because he misses the joy her physical touch brought him. Is he purposely trying to make us picture him jerking off? Another seduction tip, guys. Don't use the words, "the joy your physical touch brings me," ever. So Sean arrives, he's feeling uneasy, and he has an uneasiness in his gut right now, which could be one of three things. Airplane omelets, am I right? The need for a good probiotic because of his anti-scabies meds, or a voodoo curse. All equally bad. Doesn't matter which one, because he's made it out of the airport bathroom in time to make it to Abby's house or hotel rental for the week of filming, and he knocks on the door, and there she is. Hades' most radiant, unapologetic scam artist. And he says, "Hi, baby." And she screams, "Mashed potatoes." Is this a nickname that refers to an infected scabie bite? His not so rock hard abs? I mean, how could mashed potatoes possibly be a nickname? What could have happened? Well, wait, don't answer that. Thanksgiving's right around the corner, and I will not have these assholes ruin the best part of the meal. Moving on. Abby thinks Sean's visit this time feels better than before because she's already met him, and so now she misses him. Okay, Abby. Sure, okay. Without skipping a beat, Sean says, "I brought a ton of clothes because someone told me to bring more clothes, and she was awfully demanding." And we learn that they have a little business venture where Abby resells to clients that she knows. And he's brought 5 huge duffel bags. Now, Abby's eyes were as big as those bags, and she was doing the math like one of those genius MIT students in that movie 21. And Sean tells Abby, "Ugh, I'm so worn out." And Abby smiles bigger than when Chris arrived, because she knows if Sean is worn out, then he probably won't be able to swirl. Now, as if the producers saw the same thing, they show Abby's one-on-one where she says, "I love Sean. I want to be with him," and makes no eye contact and rolls her eyes. Is Sean just banging the acting ability out of her because she can't even come close to faking it anymore? So they're on the couch, Sean's exhausted, and he leans over and does this slow motion, dramatic, wet-lipped cheek kiss. Ugh. And he says he's just being cautious because he doesn't want a third divorce. There's these glimmers of he's a good guy here and there with Sean, but then he chooses to say and do and act on these gross things and completely ignore massive detour signs. He's like the Clark Griswold of relationship red flags. So they're sitting down to eat at a restaurant, and Sean decides to ask about Chris one more time to be sure Abby isn't seeing him or communicating with him like she had promised. As if it were even worth her breath to say, Abby says to producers, "Since he left, my relationship with Chris changed for the sake of Sean." And she tells Sean, "I knew I had to end my friendship with Chris, and I did, but I will keep doing business with him." Now, Sean's head immediately did a Sheree Whitfield, "who gon' check me, boo," pivot. And he says, "I don't understand. What business are we talking about?" Well, apparently Abby has Chris bringing her clothes to sell too. So that's the long con. It's not even the K-1 visa, huh? Still blind to that, Sean asks, "What kind of business relationship can he provide that we can't? Why? What's the purpose?" Now, one point for Sean, because he did call her out. But Abby will see your one point and raise you a master manipulating royal flush. And she responds, because I want to. It's your insecurities, your fears. I hate hiding things, and I hope that you see that. How the hell Sean fell for that is beyond me, because he caves and says he can't control her and he doesn't want to be that kind of controlling boyfriend. So he's fine with it and she can just do whatever she wants as long as she stays faithful and doesn't mess around with Chris. And then, you know, you saw it. Abby laughed. Mother effing laughed right at him in his face. Like, and I can't believe he's still staying with me. I was trying to make him so upset that he'd leave again, and he's sticking around. It looks like Sean hears something tonight in the tell-all that upsets him and lights a match underneath him. Something about Chris using her as a sex toy. But I don't know, because isn't Sean kind of doing the same thing? And also, Abby's always saying, oh, she's crying. But I think she's actually laughing like she always does, where she laughs into her hands. So I'm anxious to see what happens. Now, it's been 2 weeks since we've seen our next couple, Darcy and Jesse Von Trapp. I was bracing myself for a scene of Darcy in a high chair with Jesse feeding her baby cereal. Baby wants some oatmeal. Here comes the bee airplane. But Darcy has graduated to a big girl seat, and she's now in middle school and saying, I don't want to go. And then, whoa, post-production, one-on-one with Darcy in a bad wig. For those of you who haven't watched it yet, think Kim Zolciak, season one, Real Housewives of Atlanta meets cheap Party City Halloween witch wig. But besides the wig, Darcy actually looked fantastic. Looks like she lost some weight. Her makeup was on point, and she's looking great. Clearly, they had to do some post interviews, and knowing that, it makes what she says all the more interesting and the foreshadowing as to what's going to happen in this tell-all. But for now, we're back to Jesse's House of Horrors. He's drinking from a little mini coffee cup. I like to think he wants his apartment to feel like Lilliput, just to make himself feel large and important. You really get a chance to take in his natural habitat. The naked bust sculpture, the retro chair, the flame sphere. You see, Jesse fancies himself a very deep, deliberate thinker. I gave her significant gift. Now, let's stop right there, Jess. Is that a real diamond? It cannot be that significant. No way, right? He isn't going to drop coin on just an appreciation ring. He'd be the type of guy that would not let you forget what a sacrifice it is or how much he paid for that diamond ring. That is a QVC Diamondique if I ever saw one. Now, this romantic Aryan model of a man says, remember you came in with all your junk? At first, it was a big challenge living in that apartment with someone who is complete opposite of who I am, but I'm going to miss her. I think he was just trying to rub it in that his hairline isn't receding like Darcy's because he's wearing this pretty little comb headband slicked back. But alas, it's time for Darcy to leave. So Jesse rolls out her large suitcase, which he's had plenty of practice with all the dead bodies he's carried away of girlfriends past, allegedly. And it took some time for Darcy because, you see, Jesse had a wall up, opened up in many ways, and he makes her feel like the luckiest girl in the world now. Really? The luckiest girl? For starters, you're not a girl. You're a grown woman with two girls at home. And you're so lucky that he took you to his mom, Betsy Johnson's Dreamcatcher shop, let his stepdad liken your uterus to Stonehenge, assigned himself as your sober living coach, and kept you in the appreciation zone after he almost murdered you in a windmill. Oh, and he gifts her his army fatigues because clearly he just needs more room for his minimalist lifestyle in his closet and doesn't have time to bring it to the Amsterdam Goodwill. And it's not nearly tight enough to show off his new pectoral muscle that just popped. Now, Darcy, the modern day Sandra D, says, "Hopefully one day I'll take your name. I have my commitment ring and I won't take it off." So they settled on commitment ring, I see. That must have been a late night fight. Because Jesse will get married one time and one time only. Such a romantic, right, ladies? They finally get to the airport, and I was searching for tears to actually fall from his eyes, but I didn't see any. He had Abby non-tears. So Darcy asks, "Do you really love me?" Which is every woman's way of saying, "Tell me how much you love me because I want to hear it, please." And Jesse, the control freak, says, "You know I do." These two have such different styles of love, love language, affection. There is no way they could last. Or if they did, they would be miserable. Actually, you know what? Jesse wouldn't give a fuck, but Darcy would be miserable. So now here's the post-production bad wig foreshadowing. Darcy says, worst case, love fades away. I feel in my gut that he wants to be my husband, but we'll have to see what happens when I go back home. We'll see, time will tell. I think it would have been fine if they just left it there, but they don't. They then decide to include a scene of Jesse with the headband again saying, "I believe some people put a time frame on when to propose. I don't believe that. Only the heart can tell you, nothing else." I've got to think that the producers gave us a reason for that, and I hope to see what that reason is tonight. Now, I saved the best for last. Paul and Karini. We left off last week with the proposal, with that sad, sad, cheap red rose box. And Karini is still saying, "Oh my God." I myself have been saying that all week. I'm saying it so much, my kids are even saying it because it's just so fun. "Oh my God." I've already had a plan. I'm just going to say it every time I open the door to trick-or-treaters tomorrow. "Oh my God, and Elsa. Oh my God, Darth Vader." So anyway, Paul is still on one knee, but luckily he's only 78 pounds, so he's not heavy enough to sink into the sand like I would have at this point. And he's just kneeling there, or as he calls it, he's sitting on one knee. And he tells Karini, "You look in shock." So now she's having to use the phone to translate what he's saying, what she wants to say. Damn, the thing that phone has had to see and say, it's the real victim here. And then he takes out the ring, and I am dying to see what piece of shit cubic zirconia he has picked out. I had already told myself that he would be the type of guy that would pick out a heart-shaped stone. Ugh. But he's holding the ring with his grubby, dirty finger on top of the stone. Not that I could expect Paul to know that you don't hold a ring like that. He probably rubs his mom's rings like that when they cuddle. Oh, can't you see it? So finally we get a glimpse of the ring, and it looked to be a faux sapphire. Come on, really, Paul? Karini deserves something more than that for sleeping next to you, let alone with you. And still she's not answering, so Paul just tries to put it on before she can say no. And he's like, "Oh, this is where I put it on your finger, I think. You all right?" And he's trying to shove it under her hand. And then it got confusing because he's like, "Yes," and she goes, "No." And he's like, "No," and then she goes, "Yes." The roller coaster of emotions was intense, more intense for us than it was for Paul. That I'm sure, because He is not fully developed in that area of his brain. Then a mosquito who knows about karma came down to deliver just a tiny dose of malaria. And I smiled knowing that Paul would have a sleepless night on WebMD diagnosing himself. He tries to spin Karini around like he does to his mom when she brings home a bag of Bugles and RC Cola. I can feel it in my bones that he drinks RC because he's a monster. Paul finds it ironic that they're in the middle of a ball and chain and he's with his ball and chain. And it's ironic because irony doesn't translate well with a translator app. Nor does irony about a ball and chain go over well when you're a convicted felon on parole. Felon or not, Paul appreciates that Karini loves me in a way no one ever has loved me besides my mother. I mean, I kid about him and his mom, but then he says this, and I have to wonder. And I wonder what kind of PTSD Karini is going through because she starts saying she loves Paul, even with all his flaws, and I'm afraid he won't come back. This is all over talk around the hotel pool where Karini is drinking from a coconut. And when I first saw Paul carrying it, I was relieved because I thought, oh, thank God he's going to consume some actual calories. But it was for Karini, and who can really blame a girl for needing a cocktail at a time like this? And in the haze of trauma from the machete incident and her promise to see Paul's peen for the rest of her life, they exchange Justin Bieber heart hands, and Karini expresses her fear that Paul is going to leave and not come back, that he's been deceptive in his past, and she's worried that this whole thing isn't for real. He reassures her, and then he thinks he's being funny and puts her hat on his head and then takes it off and puts it on her. And then she takes it off because you can't blame her. He hasn't showered and lice is extremely contagious. Now, as a sign of good faith, Paul is going to leave 3 of his 4 foot lockers that he's brought. Thanks? Yeah, I'm sure that won't take up 40% of the square footage of her house or anything. Okay, here it comes. The gem of a scene the editors dropped in there as a gift. No previews of it, no warning, just bam. Happy birthday, Merry Hanukkah. And he says, this is something my mom did, and I'm about to do it now. Cut to me, Ramona Singer, catwalk eyes like, oh my God. Would you like a keepsake of my hair? And he starts pulling his hair out by the root at the back of his head, just like plucking the daisies like it's normal. And then I noticed it. Did you notice it too? There's hair thinning in that area where he pulled it out. Now we know why. Do you think he grew his hair out for this trip in anticipation of producing hair memory balls for her? And then the best, worst line was, I'm pulling this out of my mom's playbook right now. Her playbook? Like his mom's got mad game. Yeah, pulling out that hair, bro. He goes, oh, it's shedding as he's yanking it out. And Karini and the entire world scream, stop! To which he says, it's not much, but it's something. I mean, what would you do, guys? I don't even like cleaning out my own hair from my brushes, let alone someone else's hair. And Paul's, and then he starts to grab her head and she screams, no, don't pull my hair. And he pulls it and then he says, probably got it. This is not even funny. It is really messed up. Just think, this is your son, your daughter, your brother, sister, best friend, and they tell you this has happened to them in the back of a taxi. Holy shit. Regardless of all of this, St. Karini makes Paul promise to come back, but all he offers is, you want my agua? You want my agua? No, Paul. No agua. No agua ever. Now, Paul starts ugly crying because he's never had to leave his hair with anyone except his mom, and this is tough for him. Except he has had to do this before. He's lying. He had to do this when he had to live in a little place called The Clink. The internet and a little middle-aged woman named Jody don't forget Paul. So they kiss and kiss and kiss goodbye, and then Paul runs back to kiss her one last time. But I saw his hand, and it's clear his OCD was driving him. He just needed that one last hair to add to his collection. Tonight on the tell-all, we get to see what makes Paul break down and run away. I'm crossing my fingers they have a Portuguese interpreter if Karini shows up, because I think we could get a lot more insight than simply what that Google Translator app is capable of. Next up, 90 Day Fiancé. Well, we didn't get to see Josh and Ika this week, so let's jump to the second most boring couple, Elizabeth and André. TLC better be teasing us with some slow motion train wreck with these two. I need more than a couple in love that has some legal issues. Give me anger management and daddy issues, or give me nothing at all. We find out Elizabeth and André applied for the K-1 visa 7 months ago, and Elizabeth has just been too busy trying out every bright shade of lip since to follow up on what the holdup is. So she's packing for Ireland to meet up with André anyway, because she thinks the delays in processing are unnecessary and it's caught up in red tape because of the politics of the United States right now. But she's not overly concerned, because a cute selfie and a first season on a cable TV show will just hurry things right along. With what I'm theorizing was a background check on André from producers, and producers instigating a lawyer to look up the case because they needed to push production along, Elizabeth and her boobs have made their way to an appointment with the immigration lawyer. The lawyer clearly knows André is the Moldovan Incredible Hulk, because she decides to ask, "Has he ever told you that he's gotten into a bar fight or anything? Maybe an arrest record?" Yeah, you need to ask him. If he didn't mention any and they found some, it can be a fraud. Oh, and there's another glitch. Has he ever been here before? He didn't violate anything, like overstay a visa or... And then Elizabeth pulling this innocent act, like she got caught just simply coming home past curfew, is like, "Oh, I think he did once." And the lawyer is like, "That's not good. You violate that. They are not going to give you another one. Anything you do or say that is outside of the truth is fraud." Well, finally, little Lizzie and her boobs start to get worried, because you see, André has some issues with being asked questions. He doesn't like confrontation or being asked about things he's done before, because he becomes combative. Combative. Lovely adjective to describe your future husband. Again, it's like this girl gets off on him being an asshole. So the lawyer tells her they are not going to like someone who is standoffish or doesn't want to answer their questions in a simple interview. So law be damned, Lizzie McBoobs is flying off to Dublin, and they're going to have to come up with a plan B. She sends some selfies along the way, and that's when I realize that she has the Courtney factor. Both are very photogenic, and they know their angles. Take that as you will. Now, another person who has some plan Bs to make is David. David. We meet up again with this couple in Thailand, where we are reminded of Annie's upbringing. Annie is from a rural area, so she nor her family are aware of David's extreme fondness for Steven Seagal geranimal linen shirt pant sets. David is still stressing about how he's going to scam Annie's parents into thinking he can pay an adequate dowry. He's fooled enough people for this long, and he's got to close the deal with a handshake before the cat's out of the bag. David, taking no ownership of his lies that got him to this point, tries to put the blame on the country of Thailand by saying, "The expectation is that all Americans have money." Well, it's probably true that in comparison, we do have more money than they do. But you chose this, David, so I don't feel bad for you, man. Annie is from a poor village. They have no bathrooms, no kitchens. And when David and Annie arrive to talk to her parents about the dowry, the whole village comes out to welcome them, and they're dancing and singing. David gets choked up and he's crying because he's never had so much love and acceptance from anyone in his whole life. This is some dark shit here. So many levels of despair and deception. They are thinking this man can help them. He is thinking what they can give him, their daughter, a sex life, and he's just worried about what he can get away with them accepting at a minimum price. Annie is not shy about what she wants from David. She knows it's a better life for her, better life for her family, and it seems like she is desperate enough to just take one for the team and marry the old guy in the red linen jammies. Her mom, Sangad, invites them in and the negotiations begin. The problem is that Annie's parents don't know that David doesn't have a lot of money, and even Annie doesn't know the extent of it. I will be the first to admit, I thought this dowry shit was a racket and they were trying to shake some money out of David. But seeing it as a cultural thing and David is only offering them 50,000 baht, I tell that bloated bug-eyed dude to fuck off too if he thought my daughter was only worth $1,500. No freaking way. So her parents lay it out there. They want 500,000 baht, 10 times the amount that he can offer, and 2 water buffalo. I mean, did her parents take a Thai improv class? Yes, and 2 buffalo. Nailed it. So we come back from a commercial and we find out that they have agreed to settle for a down payment of the 50,000 baht that David has right now, but they want the buffalo immediately. Relieved that he has been able to keep the scam afloat for now, David tells us that he's agreed to pay 450,000 baht when he can. I can tell you with every fiber of my being that this is the exact reason David got a divorce and lost his job and lost his house in the past. I have seen it and experienced it on some level, and I know this man. I don't know him, but I know this guy, and he will take a few bucks here to keep things paid at a minimum over there. He will never be able to pay that 450,000, and he knows it. He's already thinking of excuses he's going to give in the future on why he hasn't made things square. But at that point, it won't matter because Annie's going to be here in the U.S., and that's all David wants. Now, because her parents need the water buffalo now, they head to the used water buffalo lot to take a look and see if they want to test drive a few. They pull up in a scooter, and David says, "Oh, there's Papa." These old white American dudes calling their fathers-in-law Papa will never get old for me. David is wearing his red PJs, and it looks like he might be regaining some of his weight. And Annie says, "Oh, so big. David, don't move." And I was like, damn, that is so mean. But then I realized she was talking about the buffalo. And David has already agreed to buy 2 of these things. And then he finally asks, "Okay, well, how much are they?" 75,000 baht each. He needed a diaper change at that moment because he was only expecting 30 to 35,000. Again, this is David's problem. He doesn't ask questions because he doesn't want to know the answer. And he just figures, oh, I'll just manipulate my way around the problem and squirm my way out of it. He decides to put the used water buffalo salesman to the test and asks if he can go talk to his manager about why the buffalo are $75,000 because he's feeling rushed to buy today. And he hasn't even brought up his trade-in Yorkshire Terrier he could have flown in. The only problem that Annie doesn't know is that David only has put away $35,000. And by put away, he means asked his friend Chris with the no-nonsense wife to lend it to him. They decided to look at some cheaper model sedan Buffalo, and they find a nice pair for $49,000. Seeing this is his last chance to have sex with a real woman before having to invest in a silicone robot doll, David fans out all of his money like he's P. Diddy, and the locals just start howling, "Show me the money." Annie and her papa are so happy, and David hopes she loves the buffalo because they're going to be sharing a room together, because David just spent all the money needed to take Annie to America. Holy shit, this is going to be good. Now, speaking of good, let's go check in with Molly and Luis, because Molly always seems to have something good slow cooking, roasting, frying. Due to some previous DUIs that you can research on your own, Olivia is driving Molly, Luis, and little Kenzie back from the airport. Luis is in the backseat with Kenzie, who is the Jonathan Lipnicki of Georgia. It's the exact same scene as Jerry Maguire. She's on a repeat track of asking questions. Mommy, 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 mom, mom, mom. People work in buildings, right, people? People work, right, mom? I like trains. Do you like trains? Do you know my mom's boobs weigh 8 pounds? This may be an unpopular opinion, but Kenzie was driving me nuts. I would have told my kids to zip it. You can tell in the car that Luis was also thinking, what the fuck? Because he even said, I left my family in Dominican Republic. I love Molly. Oh my God. I want to be father, but I've never been so afraid. Yeah, a kid on an endless loop of questions after a 6-hour flight will do that to a man. So they arrive at Molly's house, and there he is, brother Jesse Hebert, who says, welcome to the hacienda. Could there be a more lovable man? He just wants Luis to get comfortable because I'm going to get this food going. Can we do a deep dive and see if Jesse has a lucky lady in his life? Because he sure deserves one. Luis takes a tour of the house and is thoroughly impressed that he has landed a sugar mama. He's used to a home like Family Pedro, no running water, one floor, and boy, is Luis excited to sleep in a bed. So much so that he makes sure to tell little Kenzie that she's going to be sleeping on her own from now on because he's going to be banging her mommy from now on. So they head downstairs where Jesse is cooking pork, two kinds of pork actually. Thank God Larry wasn't there. And Jesse even makes Luis a strong cocktail. Damn it, I might even be interested in Jesse right now. So Molly calls Olivia to come upstairs and we hear a typical teenage, God damn it, being screamed in the basement. Yes, I know Molly is the mom and Olivia is giving her an attitude. An attitude I would not allow in my house. However, she did just spend hours at the airport and stuck in a car with this guy. You know she's having a tough time, Molly. Give her some space, let her ease into it. She's not going to be calling the guy daddy like May and Nicole, nor would you want her to. Just let her chill out in the basement. Don't give her more reasons to pull back from you. So when Olivia finally does come upstairs, Molly almost starts taunting her. Her quote was something like, well, sometimes you have a man you want to hang out with too. Like she said that to Olivia. What the fuck are you thinking, Molly? Come on. So the next morning, Molly is frying up some bacon and she calls all her kids to the table. You know, kids, Kenzie, Luis, Olivia. Hey, Molly, you're shooting your own damn self in the foot. So Kenzie comes down, Luis comes downstairs after a great night. Ah, the best night. Oh my God, lots of kisses. Kenzie, oblivious to the debauchery that went down on the other side of her wall last night, is teaching Luis how to say cheese, and Luis fakes a smile like he likes her. And Molly serves up some burnt toast, burnt bacon. Welcome to America. She's also got some cream cheese and bagels. Sounded good to me. I would have eaten it. But Olivia is not coming to breakfast. Luis really does himself no favors by talking behind Olivia's back when he says, "What could I say about Olivia? She's wild. She does what she wants. Have to see what happens." Ooh, trust me. You don't want to see what happens when a teenage girl hears you talking about her on TV. Luis, good luck. Okay, so who shall we chat about next? Our last two couples are just about tied for the worst, but I'll mix things up and let's head to Morocco first with Nicole and Azin. Do you think it's possible for TLC to just give Nicole her own show? She has no talents, no abilities, and she makes amazing TV no matter what she is or what she does, what she says. I don't even care that I'm endorsing laziness and gluttony. I just need Nicole on my TV weekly. So anyway, we pick up where May is bolting off in an attempt to find a new Moroccan mommy. But Nicole remembers the one time her own mom let her babysit May, and she knows that Azin shouldn't be pulling her around because she remembers her mom saying that to her. Now, what stood out to me was that she told Azin, "You need to pay attention." But he was paying attention to May. I think Nicole was telling him to pay attention to her. She doesn't like how Azin is looking at her and telling her how to parent her daughter. Hey, Nicole, he's trying to save your daughter from getting run over by a rickshaw or some shit. You should be thanking him. But Nicole thinks that Azin doesn't know what's good for May because she is her mother. And then the kicker. Just because she wants something doesn't mean you have to give it to her. That's you, Nicole. Your entire family is trying to teach you the same lesson. Just because you want something doesn't mean you should get it either, Nicole. Your sponsorship money for Azin, your whisking your daughter off to Morocco for months, your donuts on your bedside, you are such a hypocrite. But Nicole is trying to convince herself and us that she's thought things through. So they're going to eat at the hotel to talk about parenting. Yeah, it had nothing to do with you being tired from walking around earlier. Or May having a bolo for her because she's ransacked some market vendor's carts. The hypocritical statements Nicole makes every time she opens her mouth would be funny if it weren't so infuriating because it involves her child. For example, she said, "If Azin can't listen to me about what's best for May, then maybe Azin isn't ready to be a parent." Oh, kind of like your mom telling you that you should listen to what's best for May? Maybe you are not ready to be a parent, Nicole. She thinks they struggled on parenting today. Like they're talking about, oh, they struggled mulching the yard or fixing that broken faucet. Let's just fix that real quick. She's just a special kind of moron. She admits that she was getting flustered, but she wants Azin to co-parent and listen to her when she tells him something about May. So Azin very calmly and rationally says, "Okay, but if I don't like something, I need to say something." Then Nicole says, "Okay, well, then we can talk about it, but don't just say it. We have to talk about it." What the fuck does that mean? Talk about it, don't say it. Okay, talking requires words, Nicole. My anger bubble bursts because all of a sudden, because May, in headphones, an iPad glued to her face, screams, "Fries!" And Nicole proudly says, "That's my kid." And this is why the world hates Americans. Thanks, Nicole. Azin is just as disgusted as all of us and does as Nicole requests. He's talking about it, not just saying it. And he says, "I know it's okay in America, but I don't think it's good for kids to eat like that. I wanted to give her chocolate earlier and you said no, but this is worse." And then Nicole explains that it's chicken. Chicken nuggets are not bad. How is she so stupid? Her parents seem like lovely people. To my non-American listeners, this is for you. I speak for the country. Nicole is not representative of us. We don't like her or want her either. Azin is completely justified that he's afraid he will come to the U.S. and Nicole's not going to have healthy meals for the family, and he worries about his health and their health. Well, Nicole is a master manipulator by trade, and she has an answer for everything. She rebuts with, "Well, I'm not a stay-at-home mom. I can't cook like your mom and sister. It's not as easy as you think." Yeah, Nicole. The only people on this planet who eat healthy are people who have a woman at home cooking for them. You lazy piece of shit. I agree with Azin. She lied to Azin when she promised she was going to try and change, work out, be healthy. It's on tape, Nicole. But, you know, she tried to eat healthy, but she got stressed with her 10-hour-a-week helper job at Starbucks and her one bill to pay and free childcare. So, yeah, Azin is 100% right. She promised, she didn't do anything. She didn't keep her promise. Nicole is going to storm out next week when she's confronted with the truth, which is what she's probably done her whole life, and everyone caves in. But guess what, Nicole? We're not caving in. So let's get to the best of the worst last night. Evelyn and David. You guys, has any other person on this show taken a faster, deeper plunge from grace than Evelyn? She started out as unlikable, but damn, she is the worst. Editors couldn't even get us through episode 3 without her showing her ugliness, and it is fantastic. We begin with a leisurely drive through the suburbs in the family station wagon, because Evelyn is a spoiled 18-year-old who still lives at home, who doesn't have a job, and doesn't pay car insurance, and pretends she has a music career, so she's driving mommy and daddy's car. David wins me over by stating the fact we wouldn't be getting married if it weren't for the K-1 visa only giving us 90 days. Hey, government, important people, you listening? David is not thrilled with this slow pace of Claremont life and isn't excited about the idea of buying and living here. But Evelyn is not excited about moving. And you know she's like Nicole and know she's going to pout her way into getting what she wants. And they make their way to her favorite breakfast place, the Claremont Country Cafe. This is a big move for Evelyn because normally her mommy cuts her pancakes for her and sprinkles the salt and pepper on her eggs just the way she likes them. And then that skinny bitch had to go and eat a donut in front of me. My absolute guilty pleasure fat girl feast are donuts. How dare she? And at first, I hated David for pointing out that it was 200 calories, but then later I see the secret genius that he is, so I fully endorse his snark. But that donut was large and probably closer to 400 calories. I know my fried dough. Now, because Evelyn loves drama and attention, she plants the seed for a fiance versus friend fight. She tells David that she's excited for cake tonight at his welcome home party, but her friend Michaela is being a biatch and thinks they're moving too fast and he's using her for a green card. What a great friend Evelyn is. You want to tell him about the time she got her first period, maybe tell David about Michaela's most embarrassing moment that you've sworn to secrecy. She's horrible. So David just brushes it off with, I left Spain and Europe to come here. That's a dream life. To which our sheltered, spoiled princess responds, there's no such thing as a European dream. I've literally been saying for several weeks my European dream of exploring cafes with Miriam, but it's a shock to Evelyn that people don't want to hear her croon off key about Jesus with her family band in the U.S. Jesus Christ, Evelyn, you are not that special, sweetheart. That's the new goddammit, Larry. Jesus Christ, Evelyn. But now we get to the most important thing that Evelyn has been planning her whole life, that long 18 years of hers. David's friends are flying in from all over the world to be there for the wedding. Evelyn interrupts, if this is about the tuxedo, I'm going to have a heart attack. She tells us that they've had 3 months to save $100 to rent a tuxedo. Listen, I told my bridesmaids, you don't get the dress, you aren't in the wedding. Such a good Christian girl, right guys? I'm not changing my wedding for these guys who don't want to rent their tuxedos. Now, David rationally tries to explain to her that they're spending thousands of dollars to be there in support of him, in support of them as a couple, but she's got her nose in the air like Cameron on Real Housewives of Dallas. And you hear the cracks forming when David explains how she's very young, she needs to be more flexible. And he said, if you plan for a foreigner husband, I think you should take his culture into consideration. And then Evelyn sees her in and thinks she's so smart and says, one fact, if you're getting married in America, you have to know how we do it here. Then David just puts the death nail in the best comeback ever and says, another fun fact, you're getting married to a foreigner. Bon appetit. I mean, the only way he could have made that better was to end it with a bon appetit, motherfucker. So I thought I'd end this podcast with some other fun facts for Evelyn. Fun fact, your hair sucks. Fun fact, you look like a fool wearing a swimsuit to the airport. Fun fact, your parents probably prayed for your husband early so you get the fuck out of there. Fun fact, if it's only a few $100, go book a gig with your family band and pay for the tux yourself. Fun fact, I'll be thinking of fun facts about you for the rest of the season. It feels so good to hate her, doesn't it? Thanks for popping in and listening today. I'll be back with a recap of the Before the 90 Days Tell All Part 2 and hopefully another fun episode later this week that I think you'll really enjoy. Remember to come laugh with us between episodes on Instagram and Facebook, Welcome to Reality TV, and on Twitter at Reality TV Pod. New episodes are always up to date wherever you listen to your podcasts or directly on welcometorealityv.podbean.com. Please rate and leave a review. Have a great Monday, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.